Our next case for this morning is Massey and Murray against Conseco. Zukowski? Is that more or less it?
Okay. Please the court. My name is Ron Wachikowski, and I represent Mr. Murray and Mr. Massey on this appeal of the decision by the district court in the Southern District of Indiana. That decision had two elements. It first held that the federal district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction, and then held that the complaint was dismissed with prejudice. We submit that that decision was an error for basically two reasons. The first is that a court without jurisdiction cannot dismiss with prejudice. This court, in the Frederickson case in 2004, in an opinion by Judge Posner, stated, a suit dismissed for lack of jurisdiction cannot also be dismissed with prejudice. That's a disposition on the merits which only a court with jurisdiction may render. No jurisdiction and with prejudice are mutually exclusive.
But I thought actually it was Judge Easterbrook who wrote that opinion, but it doesn't matter. It's the court has its opinions.
That's true.
The real theory here, at least getting beyond that problem, is that a 41A second dismissal is, in effect, a sanction. Your opponents argue it belongs in the Rule 11 kind of box. And even if there's no subject matter jurisdiction, a court retains the power to take measures, for example, under Rule 11. So maybe you could address that.
The court does retain power to impose sanctions under Rule 11. It does not... That power does not extend to entering a judgment on the merits or entering a motion to dismiss with prejudice. In fact, in the Szabo case where that principle was upheld, and that it was not a sanction under 41A1, but a sanction under Rule 11, this court said that even though it lacked jurisdiction, it could still impose sanctions under Rule 11. But it said in that context, a court has jurisdiction to determine its jurisdiction and therefore may engage in all the usual judicial acts, even though it has no power to decide the case on the merits.
So you would read Szabo as saying that the kind of sanctions would be fines or other sorts of measures, not dismissals on the merits.
Cannot be extended to dismissals on the merits. And I would go further, Your Honor. I don't believe that there is any case that has survived appellate scrutiny by any court that has said we lack jurisdiction but we still make a ruling on the merits. This would really be a major change in jurisprudence to allow this to stand, and I don't think it can in light of the court's prior holdings. And the prior holdings relating to sanctions don't extend that far.
Now, what about all this confusion about who raised the jurisdictional point first and whether there was, whether in effect your opponents are switching sides on this point? Your reply brief, you quote from their memorandum.
I give their complete discussion of that issue. And you see in that discussion that they raise the jurisdictional issue. They call it to the court's attention. They call to the court's attention the fact that this is a declaratory judgment action. And a declaratory judgment action, the well-pleaded complaint rule has a particular application. That is, you don't look at the complaint from the perspective of the plaintiff. You look at it from the perspective of the defendant and what claims he would have or it would have. And then they conclude with the statement, if plaintiff's claims are set-off claims, then they fall outside the well-pleaded complaint rule and no federal question jurisdiction exists requiring dismissal of the complaint. Our claims are set-off claims. They correctly point out that there was a bankruptcy. Other claims, affirmative claims, were discharged in the bankruptcy. What we were asserting by this declaratory action were set-off claims.
But what they claim, actually, at this point, I guess, is that you're playing a delaying game and you just don't want Conseco to recoup these rather impressive amounts of money that your clients had from these director loans.
We respectfully submit that's not the case, Your Honor. When Conseco raised this issue and alerted us to this, let me just say it's not a rule with which I was previously familiar. We asserted three claims that asserted federal statutes. We didn't realize, because it's a declaratory judgment action, things are reversed, and that doesn't raise a federal question. We learned that when we got their brief. This court has told us repeatedly, if there's a jurisdictional question, it's your duty to acknowledge it and bring it to the court's attention. When we saw, particularly in light of the prior ruling of the federal district court in this case, and it's also a matter of public record, there was a prior ruling by the bankruptcy court as to jurisdiction on claims like this, that the likelihood is that it could not survive that challenge on jurisdictional grounds. Our duty was to acknowledge that and to file the document which we entitled a notice of consent to dismiss. And that, we respectfully submit, was not in any way a Rule 41A1 dismissal.
Well, you state that your notice of consent to dismiss called for action by the court, but it was only your motion for leave to file a second amended complaint that requested court action, right?
The court action had already been requested by the defendant. The defendant had filed a motion to dismiss. The defendant had argued, as I just read to you, that would needed to be dismissed. What we were saying, the court had before it a motion to dismiss. We were consenting to the argument that we understood them to have made.
But why shouldn't we review the notice as a notice of dismissal under Rule 41?
Because we were inviting court action, both in terms of the action that had already been requested by the defendant and also the action.
Nor
were
you joining in the request.
Pardon?
I assumed you were joining in the request.
That's why we characterized it as a consent.
But your characterization is not what carries the day. I mean, if you are asking the court to do something, you're asking for court action.
We were saying defendant had
asked. They asked for it, and we agree.
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
They
asked
for it, and we agree.
And so we're asking the court to act.
No, that is you're jointly asking the court to act.
Right.
I think that's correct.
But that doesn't mean you didn't ask. It meant you asked jointly.
I think that's correct.
Okay.
I think that is correct characterization.
Well, and the bottom line is the court did act, too.
Exactly. So it understood that.
No matter who was asking, you've got Rule 12H3. Which says, when anybody suggests a lack of jurisdiction, could be one of the people sitting in the courtroom today, the court has a duty to take that.
Don't everybody jump up at once.
Yeah. Right. We don't need that too much. But the fact is, it was up to the judge to decide once this was called to his attention.
That's correct, Your Honor. So it was a matter for the court to act.
Now, why didn't you seek to sign a stipulation of dismissal with the defendants under Rule 41, and then you could have avoided the two dismissal rule after the defendants filed their motion to dismiss?
To be honest, we never thought that anybody could possibly think of this as a Rule 41A1 dismissal. We knew what a 41A1 dismissal was. We had done it once before. It's when you file a document which of its own accord dismisses the case. That's not what we were filing here. We were filing a response to their motion to dismiss. And we didn't conceive of it that way. We thought we were in essence saying they ask for it, we agree they should get it. And so in essence, in fact the trial court used the word that it was in fact our stipulating to what they had asked for. I do want to reserve just a short time for rebuttal.
That's fine. We'll hear from Mr. Hackney now.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Hackney, and I represent the Conseco entities who are the defendants below and who are the appellees herein. I'd like to start with a very important point that came up just at the end there, which was, why didn't you ask to stipulate to the dismissal of the case without prejudice with the defendants? And the true answer to that question is that they did ask. And this can be found in their one of their own briefs that they submitted. It was their response to our motion for interlocutory appeal. And what they stated in that response was correctly, they had called and asked that we stipulate to a dismissal without prejudice because, in their view, there was no jurisdiction. And what we told them was, no, we don't agree that there's no jurisdiction. And I think it's noteworthy to point out.
But you have taken so many positions on that. And I guess I have to say, Mr. Hackney, that at the end of the day, if you look at Rule 41A1, it talks about an action being dismissed by the plaintiff without order of the court. It doesn't say without an order of the court that somebody asked for or that everybody asked for or anything. It just says without order of court. And that's not what happened here. Judge McKinney dismissed on motion, and he issues an order of the court. He makes a finding that you are now taking issue with, in fact, that he has no jurisdiction, and he dismisses on order of the court. So taking the rule at face value, it's very hard for me to see how you get into the rest of it with the two dismissal rule.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, Judge McKinney's own order has the answer to that question, which is in his order finally deciding the case, he acknowledges his prior error in failing to recognize the import of the notice of consent to dismiss. And he says, and I quote, plaintiffs did not move to dismiss their complaint, comma, they noticed their dismissal.
But that doesn't matter. They didn't have the power to get rid of this case just on notice. He dismisses it for lack of jurisdiction. The court determined that because it did not have subject matter jurisdiction. Then he goes over into Szabo, which actually, as your opponent points out, excludes merits dispositions. This isn't it's not a voluntary dismissal to say there's no subject matter jurisdiction. There's no volition about it at all. If the court has no power, the court has no power.
Well, I guess if I could divide the jurisdictional part into two pieces and take the first part first, which is whether or not jurisdiction existed in the lower court. We believe that jurisdiction did exist in the lower court for the simple reason.
But how do you explain that long excerpt in the reply brief? I'm very troubled by the way this has been handled by you guys.
Let me explain it, Your Honor, because I think it could use explanation. But let me also be clear that we have never moved under 12b-1 for dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
The motion didn't say that, but there's that long excerpt, and you're quite familiar, I'm sure, with Rule 12h-3.
There is. If I could explain, Your Honor, in this case, one of the key concerns with their claims was we felt that we had them either coming or going. If they were affirmative claims, they violate the discharge injunction entered at the end of Conseco's bankruptcy and therefore could not stand because they were not raised prior to the discharge injunction. If they were set-off claims, they fell within a waiver of set-off provision that was contained in the credit agreements that underlie the loan program. And what I was trying to do in that provision that's cited at length in the brief inartfully was remember what we were facing at that point. The defendants had on three occasions said federal subject matter jurisdiction exists in their complaint. And note, we did not disagree with them. In fact, that's why we filed a 12b-6 motion, not an alternative 12b-1 motion. And what we said is, what that paragraph is supposed to say is, we know federal question jurisdiction exists.
No, but it doesn't say that, actually.
What it says is, if they are affirmative claims, they are barred by the discharge injunction. If they are set-off claims, we don't understand how they could fall within a well-pleaded complaint.
It says, then they fall outside the well-pleaded complaint rule, and no federal question jurisdiction exists, requiring dismissal of the complaint.
If you read the rest of the brief, we then argue that they are not set-off claims. We argue that they are affirmative claims for relief.
At that point, having raised the issue, it's the district court's responsibility to come to a decision as to whether he has subject matter jurisdiction or not.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. And
it doesn't make any difference what you think, and the parties can't stipulate to jurisdiction. You know that.
The two arguments bleed together somewhat. I was answering the court's question in order to establish that we were not attempting to play funny games in the lower court with respect to jurisdiction. Our position has been that jurisdiction exists. We never moved to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. And our position today is that jurisdiction existed over the complaint because it stated claims arising under federal law and asked for relief. And therefore, we think if the lower court's determination that jurisdiction did not exist is erroneous, you should affirm because
then
the second...
Then we remand for the district court to continue with the case because the predicate for the district court's decision was that he lacked jurisdiction.
The predicate for the district court's decision, Your Honor, was that the plaintiffs in this case had voluntarily dismissed their claims twice, and secondarily, that jurisdiction was not necessary to operation of the two dismissal rule. This court, if it finds that jurisdiction did exist, can affirm his finding that there were two dismissals under Rule 41.
But you had already filed it. I mean, there's so many other issues about that. You had already filed an answer, and actually, that's usually a provision that protects defendants because what we don't want is a system where there's dismissal number one, and then an answer is filed, and then the plaintiffs come in with an amended complaint and say, oh, we got another free bite at the apple. So defendants, usually the posture is defendants coming in saying, yes, the answer was filed at the first complaint, but now you have to come to the court. And you are turning this around because today it suits you, but it's in general, it's a rule that protects defendants.
Well, it protects defendants when it's taken the first time without prejudice, as happened in the Armstrong case. But when it is taken the second time,
it's not even a second. You don't even have the right to do it the second time.
Well,
state in your brief with no citations that it would make sense to allow every amended complaint to have a free, dismissal on notice. But
there are many things under the federal rules that you cannot do. You are supposed to file an answer within 20 days. But if you file one within 30 days, it doesn't mean that we pick up the answer and say, this is just an inoperative document. It still goes into the court files an answer. And this court still found the notice of dismissal to be a notice of dismissal. Moreover,
the district court did. We're deciding, what it is.
That's correct, Your Honor. But below, the plaintiffs did not preserve their argument that they had violated Rule 41 and should not have been permitted to do what they did. Moreover, I think there's a serious question as to where Rule 41's protections are at issue. We are, after all, seeing complaints here that have been serially dismissed on two opportunities.
You could file a motion under 1927. You could file a motion under Rule 11. I thought your parade of horribles was very unpersuasive, because the truth is a plaintiff that abuses like that would look like the plaintiff in Fredrickson, and this court said you can't make a ruling on the merits just because a problem like that has come up.
Well, it's always true that there are other avenues to sanction the plaintiff, Your Honor, but the drafters of Rule 41 saw fit to include the two dismissal rule despite the presence of the federal statutes in Rule 11 that you reference.
Dismissals meeting the description of the rule.
That's correct. But again, Your Honor, the district court below found that there was a notice of dismissal. We do not believe it would be an abuse of discretion where the notice was not styled as a motion. It didn't have a prayer for relief. It was not a stipulation. It wasn't signed by the other party. And it was not an involuntary order by the court. It was action by the plaintiff that was voluntary within the meaning of the circuit court cases we've cited. If I could go back to the point of jurisdiction for a moment, though, Your Honor, we think that the district court in this case improperly applied the notion that if there is a declaratory claim, you automatically consider the coercive complaint that will be filed by the opposing party. That ruling, we believe, violates the State of Illinois v. General Electric decision in this court, as well as the Aristic holdings. And what those two cases said is, it does not matter if a claim could potentially be raised as a defense to a complaint by your opponent. It is where it could only be raised in such a circumstance that you have a federal jurisdiction problem because you are expanding the jurisdiction of the federal courts. That is not the case here, where the plaintiff is seeking under federal statutes rescission and affirmative equitable remedy and declarations that are all based on federal law. It is just like the plaintiff in the State of Illinois versus General Electric case, where General Electric was unwilling to sit around and wait for the Attorney General to sue it for violating the Nuclear Waste Act in question. It wanted to move affirmatively to secure and perfect its rights under Ex parte Young to say it was not violating the law. Similarly, a plaintiff like Massey and Murray here might say, I'm unwilling to sit around and wait until Conseco sues me. I'm going to sue affirmatively under the federal securities laws, the securities tying laws, under Regulation U, and get an order from a court saying that the contracts are invalid or illegal, or that they should be rescinded, or that I'm entitled to damages. Those are federal claims that arise under federal law. And just as the parties cannot stipulate to jurisdiction, they cannot stipulate jurisdiction away if it exists. We believe that jurisdiction existed in the lower court, that the lower court made a proper and correct finding that there had been two dismissals under Rule 41, and that the case was dismissed with prejudice. If there are no further questions, I'm afraid my time has already run. So thank you very much.
Yes, Mr. Wojciechowski.
I would like to address just two issues. The point was made that we did not preserve the issue of whether this was or was not a Rule 41A1 dismissal. We filed four briefs in the district court before its ruling where we argued it was not a 41A1 dismissal. We cited a number of facts in support of that. We did not cite the fact that they had filed an answer. That was cited after on a motion to correct error following the court's ruling. We believe that fits well within this court's prior guidance in Dugan, where this court said it's permissible to add additional facts to buttress arguments or issues previously preserved. We submit that the issue was preserved in this fact, buttresses our position. The second point I would simply make is that Rule 41A1, to the extent that it establishes a two-dismissal rule, does so to address abusive conduct. When a defendant raises lack of subject matter jurisdiction, as the defendant did here, and the plaintiff says, yes, there's a problem, and agrees with it, that is not abusive conduct and does not warrant the severe sanction of a dismissal with prejudice.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.